Welcome back to the second season of Sax Reel. This season is brought to you in part by Key Leaves. Are you suffering from sticky sax keys or striving to keep your instrument healthy? Check out Key Leaves and use the code SAXREEL for a special discount at keyleaves.com. That's key like a saxophone key and leaves like leaves keys open to dry. Key Leaves. Welcome back to another episode. This week, I'm very excited to have a member of the award-winning Cinta Quartet, who is also serving as the professor of saxophone at the Schwob School of Music at Columbus State University. I'm very happy to welcome Dr. Joe Girard.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor to be here, Jonathan.
So I always like to start off with a little bit of background on who you are and how you got into music and what brought you to start studying music in your undergraduate.
So I think like a lot of saxophone players, I started in sixth grade in the band program at school and public schools. I had taken piano lessons starting in about second grade, so I had some familiarity with learning music before that. And so picked the saxophone up in sixth grade. I was absolutely terrible. I kind of thought, you know what, I don't know if I want to do this. After sixth grade, my mom wouldn't let me quit, so she sent me to a music camp. It was about a week long, and said, you know, if you go here, you don't like it, then you can reconsider. I met there a gentleman by the name of Jay Berkeley, who was at the time a student at the University of Michigan studying with Donald Cinta. And it really kind of transformed my perception of the instrument. I had a ton of fun. I learned quite a bit. I came back in seventh grade and I wasn't terrible. And so that kind of spawned an interest early on. Jay, I think now is actually an administrator somewhere in Houston, Texas. But I bring his name back up because I was very fortunate to go to a high school that had a strong tradition of saxophone. I went to Plymouth Canton High School, now it's Canton High School, and he taught private lessons there when I was in middle school. Zach Sheeman was one of his teachers. Zach Sheeman was actually my first private saxophone teacher. I started studying with him in eighth grade. We all know Zach at UMKC. Before Zach, Christopher Blossom was also a graduate of Canton High School. Actually, it might have been Salem. I think Zach went to Salem. Plymouth Canton, Plymouth Salem. There's two. At the time, there were two. Now there are actually three high schools on the same campus. Chris Blossom, who is in the Army Field Band, was a saxophonist who graduated from my high school. And even before Jay and those guys, Andy Dahlke is from the Plymouth Canton area of Michigan too. So there's a long history of saxophone, and I was extremely fortunate to grow up in that type of culture. And growing up about 20 minutes outside of Ann Arbor, I had, you know, the fortune of being exposed to the quality of music making going on there at a very early age in high school. I did the Michigan Youth Ensembles, which meet on Sunday afternoons. Crossed paths with Stephen Davis, who was a director at the University of Michigan at that point. Now, I think we all know him at UMKC as the director of bands. I had the good fortune of studying or working with him for 2 weeks at Interlochen. So back in the day, my day, the All-State program at Michigan, or in the state of Michigan, was at Interlochen. So I worked with Steve Davis for 2 weeks there and fell in love with the place and had the opportunity to go and study the next summer for 8 weeks with Tim McAllister, who is teaching saxophone there. And that was, you know, a huge influence on my early development. So that kind of transitions me into my undergrad, where I went to the University of Michigan. It seemed kind of like the natural trajectory at that point in my life. Plus, I just grew up loving Michigan football. So that's a huge part of it too.
It seems like you had a really good, strong start where you just had a lot of opportunities to learn from some really amazing musicians. And I love that there was that long history of saxophone playing at your high school. When you started your undergraduate degree, did you know that you wanted to go into music, or was that still something where it was a thought, but not a full on, I'm committed to this yet?
The latter. I went into my undergrad as a double major, and I had always enjoyed music. I grew up in southeastern Michigan, and my father worked for General Motors at the time, where I was, you know, figuring out what I'm going to do with my future. And I really thought that I was going to be an engineer. I had studied mechanical engineering at University of Michigan at the same time that I was studying saxophone performance. So I did both degrees simultaneously, taking 5 years with a ton of summer courses, you know, to fulfill the requirements.
I can only imagine.
I think I graduated with something like 210 or 212 credits or something like that. And, you know, I really thought that I would just kind of play saxophone for fun. I would go into probably the automotive industry because that was like one of the biggest employers of engineers in that region of Michigan. And I really actually quite enjoyed that aspect of you know, what I did in high school. I enjoyed the physical sciences. I enjoyed, you know, math, all of that kind of stuff. I've always enjoyed taking things apart and putting them back together. And I think I'll come back to that later on when I talk about my teaching. And so, you know, I double majored. I didn't really realize until later in my undergraduate studies that I wanted to pursue music as a possible career. You know, I just want to make the point, like, the double major taught me a lot. And I often get the question, you know, would you do anything differently? You know, no, I have absolutely no regrets. I learned to manage my time very, very well and prioritize how I spent my time and balance, you know, engineering with music and, you know, chamber rehearsals and my own teaching private studio and trying to have a social life, you know, at the same time. I think you have to find that balance. And I learned very early on in my undergraduate degree how to do that because I was pulled in 12 million different directions all at once. And I kind of thrive, I think, in that situation. There were three things that really changed my trajectory and took me towards a music degree. And I think the first one was success I had with a group. I played with the Yersinia Saxophone Quartet. And so that group, Zach Stern and I were both on the middle voices, just like we are with Cinta Quartet. We were playing with Dr. Young, Bobby Young on soprano, and then one of our classmates, Dan Blumenthal, on baritone. He's now, I believe, an orchestra director in Syracuse, New York. He's another interesting double major. He played violin and saxophone, and yes, had both of those as his primary instrument while he was at the University of Michigan. Phenomenal musician, and I'm sure very successful teacher at this point. So that group got a silver medal at Fischhoff in 2009, and we had some success at the NASA competition too. I can't remember what year or how we placed because my memory of those things is not very good. But yeah, that was the first thing. So I had a little taste of success, and I was like, oh, maybe this is something that I could do, you know. The second part of it was I started teaching private lessons to make money my freshman year of college. And to be quite honest, I was teaching some middle school students in the later part of my high school studies. I had a few students. And, you know, during my undergraduate through my doctoral degree, at any given point, I had a private studio of anywhere from 8 to 20 students on a weekly basis. I went from a necessity of making money to like extreme like enjoyment and fulfillment from working with students. So that was, you know, the second part of what kind of changed my trajectory. And the third part was I had had a few internships in the automotive industry at that time. And there was one in particular, I think it was before my fourth year of undergrad, probably around 2008. I was interning at a company called Akebono Engineering, and they specialize in brake systems all the way from IndyCar racing down to, you know, your Honda Accord. I ran brake tests with Honda Accord brake pads in 2008, 2009, all that kind of stuff. It was somewhat interesting, but I could not stand sitting at a computer for about 40 hours a week analyzing brake data. And, you know, I realized not every engineering job was like that, but it wasn't my first experience in that setting. And on top of that, you know, I looked around and asked myself, okay, that guy's been here for 5 years. He's working the same hours I am at the same type of desk. He's getting paid a lot more. Great. That guy's been here for 10 years doing the same thing. And I didn't enjoy it. I would go crazy if I was doing the same thing in the same situation like that for that long period of time. So that spoiled my desire kind of to go that route, especially after like graduating with an undergraduate degree, because that those are the type of positions you're going to be in, right? So I thought, all right, I really enjoy being in school. I really enjoy making music. Let's see if I can give this master's a try. And at that point, I knew, okay, if I'm going to get a master's, I'm going to get a doctorate, I'm going to teach. And it did take some convincing, you know, my family, my parents, you know, and I was always like, you know, if this doesn't work out, I do have this engineering degree to fall back on. No, you know.
There is a backup plan, yeah.
There is a backup plan. And I think, it, you know, I should mention too at this point is that my backup plan, I've been trying to find ways to bring both worlds together. I think throughout, you know, the latter part of my undergraduate degree, and I was very close to going to work for Kurt Alterac at Music Medic at one summer, and I strongly considered trying to reach out to him and like going that route after my undergraduate degrees, if master's in performance didn't work out. Had really strong connections at Yamaha, and you know, was kind of feeling out if they were looking for any type of instrument design or development stuff at that point. But I was trying to find ways to bring those two together. And ultimately, I ended up back at the University of Michigan for my master's.
I love that. I bet your parents were almost regretting forcing you to keep with the saxophone at that point.
That's funny. That's actually, yeah, what would that be? 11 years later, has decided to go a different route.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you've proven them that it was definitely worth continuing in music. I love that.
They've been really supportive throughout all of it. They really
have. Of course. So you did go on to graduate school and you did get your degrees. When did the Cinta Quartet back then, Donald Cinta Quartet, actually form?
Yeah, so officially it would have been November of 2010, right? So the beginning story goes that in spring of 2011, the University of Michigan Symphony Band was going to go on a tour, three-week tour of China, and end with a concert in Walt Disney Hall in L.A. And the reason they were going was, well, things all kind of happened together, and there's a lot that went on behind the scenes, but 50 years previously, the University of Symphony Band had toured the Soviet Union, right? And Cinta happened to be a student soloist on that trip. And so this was a tour to celebrate that 50-year previous tour. And Michael Haithcock, the director of bands, wanted in some way, you know, kind of to honor Cinta in some way because, you know, the legacy he had at the University of Michigan, that he had been on that tour previously. And so it was decided to orchestrate for wind band the William Bolcom's Concerto Grosso, because at that time it only existed in the orchestral version, which was the inception. You know, that piece was done, and so we knew that this piece was going to be featured on the tour of six countries in China, and everybody in the saxophone studio like really wanted to be on that. So we auditioned to be in the band, which was already nerve-wracking enough, and then we had to audition to be in the quartet. And so it's very odd that we started as an auditioned group. We did not choose to be together out of normal student, you know, let's play together, or our teacher putting us together. No, it just happened to be that, you know, and those auditions, we auditioned on each of those specific instruments. I had already been playing tenor, you know, in the Yersinia Quartet, and that was the instrument I felt comfortable with, and so that's what I auditioned for. And so we found out, you know, in November of 2010 that we were the ones who had were selected to play in that quartet, and that's when we started. So our first gig was a guaranteed concerto performance in six different locations, and the first piece we studied together outside of, you know, your typical warm-ups and da-da-da-da-da was Bolcom's Concerto Grosso for 6 to 8 hours a week for, you know, 4 or 5 months. So, yeah, that's how we started, actually. It's kind of unique in that way.
Yeah, I definitely never have heard of a quartet as successful as yours, especially that started off as an auditioned quartet. That's really unique. I like that. I didn't know that before.
It's unique, and, you know, we did the tour. Leading up to the tour, we got kind of sick of playing Bolcom's Concerto Grosso over and over and over. It's like it was sinking in. We wanted to play more repertoire, so we actually gave a full chamber recital like a week or two before we went on tour. And so we prepared a bunch of, you know, standard repertoire, newer standard types of pieces, some transcriptions, you know, stuff we really enjoyed playing, and we enjoyed that process, right? And afterwards, we hadn't, you know, broken up yet. We enjoyed the quality of the product we were making. We enjoyed each other's company, and so we're like, you know what? Let's continue this. We were all going to continue as students at the University of Michigan at that point. And so we started to put on chamber recitals in and around the Ann Arbor area and started to do some competitions. And so things, you know, just kind of snowballed after that.
Yeah, that's definitely an understatement. Yeah. Yeah, I love that.
And now for a word from our other sponsor, Consistency Wins. Consistency Wins was established in 2002 by Jonathan Cathell, who has over 30 years of experience working as an instrument technician. Aside from Jonathan Cathell, there are three other amazing technicians that work there: Jeremy Hill, Alex Singleton, and Courtney Christensen. All four technicians specialize in high-end setups and modifications. One thing that I really genuinely appreciate about Consistency Wins is that I know that they're not doing this just to gouge me for money. They're doing this because they genuinely love the instrument and they love making sure that we understand what they're doing. Consistency Wins doesn't use any gimmicky repair materials as a means to lure in musicians. Instead, they focus on how the instrument should properly function and provide helpful, myth-proof, tried, and tested information. This encourages less visits to the repair shop through the long-lasting services they provide. So if your instrument is out of repair and you're looking for someone who you can trust to do quality work, make sure you go to Consistency Wins. That's consistent, the letter C, wins.
So one thing I do want to kind of talk about is that transition into teaching. Of course, you have done a lot of performing and I know that you really enjoy that. But I know that you mentioned before that you really wanted to try and incorporate both of your degrees into your teaching. And I think that's something really unique that you have specifically because you have that engineering degree. So can you talk a little bit about how you have tried to apply both of those degrees into your teaching?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So my engineering degree had a huge impact on my teaching. I think my approach to a lot of things, to be quite honest. And it really boils down, I think, to problem solving in my own playing and also in how I teach, right? And so when I say that, I mean how I teach in that how I present ideas, how I diagnose issues in students playing, how I come up with solutions. I'm very, I think, process-based and also, you know, understanding like a very sequential process, right? Like you can't, it is a silly little analogy, you can't build a house without starting with the foundation, right? But I think very often we try to create the roof, right, first. And we're like, oh, it looks beautiful, right? Now, where is it going to go, right? And so I think just that sequential process has been a huge part of it. I really, like earlier on, I said I tried to find the overlap between engineering and music. And so I tried to understand like the physics of airflow and the physics of sound and the mechanics of the instrument and what we do on a more scientific level. Grounded understanding is kind of the word that I always continue to revert back to. And so one of the first places I started was, you know, the idea of fluid dynamics, right? And the idea of control over the oral cavity, right? So I was a synth student and voicing is like, oh, you know, the answer to everything. No, it's not. But a huge part of my upbringing. And so I knew about all this stuff and I could do all this stuff, but I had no idea why it worked, right? And so I was asking myself these questions. And so going back to fluid dynamics and just, fluid flow, right? So like air and water behave the same way. So an analogy I always use with students is like, okay, you have a hose, right? And the water's coming out of the end of the hose and you cover a portion of the hose, right? And the water goes faster, right? Wonderful. And so you're going to have the reed vibrating faster and you're going to have a higher pitch, right? So this idea of a nozzle, right? A little side note here is I like to draw a lot. I think it's really important to have visual representations of what we're doing, because what we talk about is so abstract. And I was teaching a high school master class at one point, and I always draw like a cone. A cone and a nozzle are exactly the same thing, right? And so an older part of my teaching that is still somewhat true, but there's more to it, is that the idea of, okay, when we're like voicing down on the mouthpiece, trying to bring pitches lower, we're essentially creating a reverse nozzle shape in our mouths, right? It's very closed in the back, it's very open in the front, and so the air slows down, the vibration slows down, the pitch is lower, right? And then the opposite is also true. If I'm open in the back and closed in the front, right? So then my air is going faster, the reed is vibrating faster, the pitch is higher, I can play overtones and altissimo. There's actually a lot more to overtones and altissimo than just the idea of that fluid dynamics. I'll come back to that maybe later. But I'm drawing these cones on the board in three dimensions and showing airflow. And I had this aha moment, right? So there's a Harvey Patel video where he's talking about the idea of forward coning. And I was like, what is he talking about? Like, what is this concept, right? The first time I saw this video as an ignorant young undergrad. And then it was like 10 years later, because maybe I'm a little slow sometimes, I was like, oh, it's the same exact thing we're talking about in voicing, right? And so I kind of circuitously came around to connecting those two ideas. And I think Harvey Patel, that idea actually came from Joe Allard, who was his teacher, right? And so like we're all kind of doing the same stuff, but we've come to it through different means, right? And I found that fascinating. But that's just like one small bit of my teaching, right? I want to understand like what's going on from a fundamental standpoint. And so I want students to ask themselves, what is the root of the problem, right? So what is the simplest mechanism that is governing what we're doing? And I think when you start asking those types of questions, you're going to be able to self-diagnose the response issues, anything that you're having on a fundamental level much more quickly, and it's going to be much more efficient, right? So I think a lot of the time in music, it happens everywhere, right? But we have these old conventions, like, you know, the blow warm air, blow cold air, or like all these things we say that elicit some type of thing that works for person X. But maybe that doesn't work for person Y or person Z, right? And so all of those people are capable of understanding like what's going on from a fundamental level, right? And if warm air works for one person and it doesn't work for another, if they understand the mechanism that's driving this, then we can all come to this understanding, and they're gonna come up with more creative ways to describe it to somebody else, a different student, right? Because we all kind of come at these things in a different way. So I think that's a huge part of my teaching. You know, the other thing, another example I use sometimes is the way I use, you know, the word pressure, right? So this comes up all the time in teaching, pressure in the embouchure, or, the corners, or the head on the top of the mouth. Like, there's different ways. We use the same word for a lot of different things. And so I try to be careful about the way I use that word, and when I use that word, what I'm actually talking about. Because for me, when I think of pressure, I go back to fluid dynamics and I make the connection between pressure and velocity, right? And so early on, like, I really had a big issue when people were talking about pressure, and like, are they referring to back pressure that you sense when you're blowing a lot of air? Are they referring to the pressure, you know, in the jaw? And you know, we have pressure on the mouthpiece. But where is that pressure like actually coming from, right? We sense it on the lower lip. We can change how all these sensations feel with the corners and the top lip. But like, how are we using that word? And let's be very meticulous about how we're defining it. So I think it's really important. You know, the language that we use is really important. And so kind of just questioning, you know, I don't want to be like, you know, devil's advocate all the time. But I'm constantly questioning, why do we use that word? Why do we do this? And I think it's made me a lot more effective in my teaching and understanding what's going on in my own plane. You know, I love to take things apart and put them back together. In high school, I would regularly take my entire saxophone apart. Not my Selmer, my marching band horn, right? So I had a cheap marching band horn that I literally, like, it'd be like a Wednesday, and I'd be bored, and I'd be like, all right, I'm gonna take everything apart, I'm gonna put it back together. I needed it for rehearsal tomorrow, so you know what? I figured it out, like, to the point where I'd taken the bow off, right? Wow. Like, the body of the horn apart, I remember the first time I did that, I got a little bit nervous. But it wasn't the last time, you know, that I did that and put it back together. And so I, that was fun. You know, I've always enjoyed that. I also, as a child, enjoyed Legos and Lincoln Logs, right?
Yeah. So, I love that. Yeah, I definitely agree with you that there's a lot of terminology that we use that's really vague, and like there's generally helps some students, but not everyone. So I actually am really similar to you in that, like, I love talking about, like, okay, if this is the problem, like, what's actually causing that, and finding the root of the issue and being able to articulate that. And oh man, I love that you do that, because that's exactly how I want to teach too. So I'm glad that there's other people who do it as well.
And it's, I think we live in, like, I feel old. Like, there's so many resources now, and like understanding of what's going on from a deeper level, right? So like I constantly pull up, and I'm sure a lot of listeners will know this, the Sarah Willis MRI video, right? Sarah Willis, the horn player. She's in the MRI machine doing like everything you could imagine on the French horn, and we get to see what her tongue is doing, right? So like that's what we're doing too. It's exactly the same. It just so happens we have the vibrating mechanism in our mouth, right? And theirs is on the actual exit of the mouth, right? But like everything that's going on from a fundamental level is the same, right? So we can discover so much from that, you know? When I was an undergrad, it was Stephen Jordheim and the Saxophonist's Anatomy that was online. It was like, you know, made your brain explode. Now we also have I'm staring at it, the Mart Watkins from The Inside Out, right? Yeah. Where it's like, he's looked at, what are we doing? What's going on? And all of these different, it's eye-opening. And so we can actually understand why we do what we do. And it's been like, you know, our instrument's been around for what, 170 years or so. And now we're
at just a little too long to get it.
Yeah, right. And now we're at, like, wind playing in general, right? Like, now we can see the mechanism of that play. Like, why is string pedagogy so far ahead of ours? And piano, you see everything that's going on. Mm-hmm. Granted, not like the mechanisms in the piano behind, you know, the keyboard, but I think that's one of the reasons why their pedagogy is so sound. Everything you can see, there's the tactile thing is there, but for us, more than half of what we do is hidden away, right? It's inside of us. So
yeah, I love
that. It's a fun time to, there's so much information out there right now to digest regarding this. It's fun.
So I do want to spend the last little amount of time that we have talking about projects that you're working on and things that you want to highlight. So is there anything that you are currently working on that you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, I guess there's like a few things. I'll start with like my solo stuff-ish and then go into some quartet stuff. So I just gave a recital August 20th, and I didn't call it a recital. I shouldn't even use that word. But so like I'm really big right now. I've played so many beautiful halls, and I say that. I hate hearing myself say that. I'm very fortunate to play in like really good spaces very often with the quartet, trying to make things happen with faculty at Columbus State University and in the community. And I wanted different settings, right? So I did my show, I called it Sax at the Gallery. I did not want the word concert. I did not want the word recital. I didn't want any of the baggage and expectations that comes with that. I did it in an art gallery that's on campus, the Beau Bartlett Center. Beautiful paintings, beautiful rotating galleries. Beau Bartlett's a local artist here. American realism is kind of what I describe it as, but they're massive. These are wall-sized murals,
wow.
Right? And so it's a beautiful space. And so I wanted it to be there. I programmed some music that I think was a little bit more accessible, right? I think programming is really, really, really important, and especially for the audience. You have to know who you're playing for, okay? You're not playing for yourself, okay? You're not playing for your teacher. You're playing for the people that are there. And who are you gonna draw in? That's the other part of this, right? So I also had a bar in the art gallery, okay? So the show started at 7. I didn't play until 7:30. There was a bar there, absolutely beautiful art gallery. And my goal was to pull in people who would not normally come to those types of faculty recitals, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it worked. Like, every seat was full. Everybody had a good time. I started the concert with like no formal announcement. It was really kind of cool. I collaborated with many of my faculty because I'm very fortunate to work with some really great musicians. But I want to do more projects like that. I'm kind of done with a recital in which you're all quiet, come out on stage and you clap, play a piece. Like, I like to talk about music too. I like to talk about these things. Like, why am I playing this piece? What is interesting to listen to? So I did a lot of that on my show. I do that, you know, I feel very comfortable doing that now because that's what the Cinta Quartet does on a regular basis. But I think that's where I want to go, is creating events, experiences that aren't so traditional and reaching new audiences. Because once you, like, share what's interesting about the music with other people, even if they're like, what is a classical saxophone, right? Like, they're going to be interested. Like, they, and so you have to kind of cultivate that. And so that's one of the things that I'm looking forward to doing, are more projects in that vein, right? One of the people I played with was Paul Viancourt, who's our percussion professor. We actually did the Uyama Divertimento, which was a heck of a lot of fun to work on. And so he and I want to collaborate more often, hopefully in a more duo format. So that's a future project. More specific things that I actually have, like, planned out, maybe. I'm actually performing with the Columbus State University Percussion Ensemble at the Georgia Music Educators Association Conference. They're doing James David's piece, and I'm not going to pronounce the French because my French is terrible, but the translation is Bird in Space, and it actually was a competition piece at the 2012 Isaac competition, which used to be at Columbus State. And then I'm doing actually a presentation, and this ties back to my obsession with voicing and the mechanics, at GMEA. I titled it the Science of a Good Sound, Voicing for the Saxophone and Other Winds. And so I'm really excited to share my thoughts and the way that I teach, and I think our understanding of the internal mechanisms at play with middle school and high school band directors, because I don't think that's an integral part of the pedagogy at that age, and I think it needs to be, because we solve a heck of a lot of issues that you see at the high school and collegiate level if we started with these concepts.
It's for sure.
Yes. Yeah, so those are some of the things. Working to start a community saxophone ensemble that's run by the students at Columbus State here in that serves, you know, our area. Big thing, too, for me right now is just the idea of serving the community that I'm in instead of trying to be in a community of something else that exists, right? So in Columbus, there's a youth orchestra. There are multiple youth choirs. There's a bunch of church. There's nothing for saxophone right now. And that needs to change. And I've been here to the point where I understand, you know, the how things function in this community. I've seen everything. And so it's time that we start something like this so that the middle school and the high school saxophone players have the opportunity, you know, once a week to be creating this stuff outside of their band program, right? So those are some of the solo things I'm doing. There's one other thing I want to mention, just because I think it's interesting, and I haven't really parsed it out yet, but I kind of wanted to talk about this earlier and I forgot. The idea of, so I started running a lot during quarantine, right, in spring 2020. So I trained for a half marathon, and then in 2021, it was my goal to run a marathon. And now I'm training for my second marathon, which is going to happen in November. But the process of that training, I find fascinating, because I was a couch potato, you know, earlier in my life. And now I can do these things, and I followed the plan, right? But what I'm really interested in doing in the future, and I've been thinking about a lot, is how we can structure our practicing based on, like, training regimens that exist in athletics, right? So we always talk about how what we do is very athletic. You know, it just happens to be that we're using smaller muscles with finer movements, right? But, like, it's no different than what's going on, you know, on a baseball field, football field, a tennis court, or anything. And I think it's fascinating. Like, I think there's something to structuring our practice in ways that reflect training for a marathon, per se. That's where my mind is right now. Because there's a buildup, right? There's a sequence, there's a taper, right? And so how can our practicing, and I think we kind of do this intuitively, but if we're all aware of this process earlier on, it'll be less, you know, stumbling over our own feet, you know, when you perform your first solo recital, right? But like working backwards from this concert date and understanding what, where you have to be at which point along the process, what days should you take breaks? You should take breaks, right? I don't think somebody should practice 7 days a week for, you know, as many hours as they possibly can. I don't think that's healthy for the body or the mind, right? And if you were a weightlifter, like you couldn't do that 7 days a week for all the free hours that you have, right? So I think there's something to that that's interesting. And so that's kind of one of my teaching projects in the near future. But then there's a lot of quartet stuff coming up too. We are in the final stages of editing Chops 3. So many are familiar with the Chops book by Dan Grazer, soprano player in the Cinto Quartet, and Chops 2. Chops 3 is a quartet method aimed at essentially any type of saxophone chamber group. I think it's going to be useful for, you know, high school groups that are trying to get off the ground. I think it's going to be absolutely useful for collegiate quartets. And even I think some, you know, professional groups may find some things interesting in there. So we're really excited about that. Hopefully, knock on wood, that's out in, you know, the next month. We're also in the middle of recording two CD projects. We did some recording in August, plans to record some more in December. Two CDs that are in the works right now is a Beethoven CD that'll feature the famous Opus 131, the Heiliger Dankesang, the slow movement from Opus 132, the Serioso Quartet, which is number 11, kind of the last quartet before his, quote, late period. And then the third movement of the third Razumovsky Quartet, which is kind of like a show-stopping encore type of piece. And then the other CD is, we're going to call it New Traditions, and it's a lot of folk and traditional music.
It's fun.
There's going to be, yeah, it's tons of fun to play. Dan got into arranging a lot of this music within the last year. You know, I think one of the first that a lot of people are familiar with what we do is like Green Groves of Erin, The Flowers of Red Hill, you know, fun, showy, double-tonguing piece. But there's tons of other great music here. There's going to be bluegrass set. There's going to be Irish reels. There's some traditional things that you're more familiar with, like Amazing Grace. There's an Irish melody called Give Me Your Hand that's going to be on there. UFO Tofu, which is actually a Bela Fleck and the Flecktones tune. I think the album is called UFO Tofu, but that's a really fun piece that we've done a couple times in the last year, and a ton of other stuff that I'm failing to recall at this moment. But those are some recording projects, and then we've luckily have a handful of gigs in the spring, which is exciting because, you know, last year's been a little dead. We had a few things last spring, but the falls are usually a little bit slower, and with things going on, I think a lot of things have been canceled this fall. So we're excited for some of the projects that are coming up in the spring as a quartet.
That's amazing. It sounds like you have a lot going on, and I love that. It's very productive.
I'm trying. Sometimes I feel like I'm just keeping my head above water.
Yeah, I feel that. But I appreciate everything you're doing. This all sounds super interesting, and I'm really looking forward to, especially the methods book for a quartet. I don't think I've ever seen a quartet methods book specifically, so that'll be really cool. Well, I just wanted to thank you once again for coming on the show. I really enjoyed talking to you. I feel like we have a lot in common in our pedagogy and what we try and focus on. So it's fun talking with someone who also is very passionate about that kind of thing. So thank you for agreeing to be on the show.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure, Jonathan. Hope to cross paths again in the near future.
Thanks for listening.